Lesson 13, Urban Movement After a Disaster. We're going to focus on three major types of post-disaster movement in this chapter. Number one, just a disaster, with no reason to be covert. People are in shock, no increased risk of violence yet. Kind of like immediately after a terrorist attack like September 11th, or an unexpected natural disaster. Number two, a disaster with civil breakdown. And this could be rioting or just general civil breakdown. When you're going out to explore, you're gathering things, or non-trade movement. And in these cases, you may have to switch to covert, specifically after an economic collapse, a predicted natural disaster with pre-planned looting by gangs like Katrina, or a breakdown in the electrical grid, food chain breakdown, etc. Or number three, a disaster with civil breakdown. And in these cases, you're going to be doing travel with the intent of shopping and trading, and you need to carry goods and currency, and may have to switch to covert. Thanks to the prevalence of video cameras, we have some great video documentation of people's reactions after the World Trade Center towers collapsed on September 11th. Two of the most common problems that the video showed were people wearing coats, blazers, and long dresses while their faces were covered in dust, and people running barefoot down the street holding their high heels and fancy dress shoes in their hands. Now, we don't have to wait for another terrorist attack to experience the same problem. Hawaii and California experience small tremors on an almost daily basis. Utah actually has over 700 seismic events a year. And many other parts of the country also have seismic activity every week. The majority are too small to feel, but they are a constant reminder that major earthquakes can happen. And when they do, people will be dealing with the debris on the ground and dust and smoke in the air, just like New Yorkers dealt with after the World Trade Center attacks. Add this the fact that volcanoes can cause the same problem. This isn't really that hard to envision. Now, the average person just spends just under half of their time away from home during the week, and it's likely that in a disaster situation, you'll start out away from home, and you'll want to get to your home as quickly as you can. Now, ideally, you'd have your 72-hour kit with you 24/7, and you would always be able to wear running and hiking shoes, but that's just not reality for most people. As a result, we need to be prepared to improvise and adapt if disaster strikes. We're not ideally dressed, and we have to have a need to travel through urban areas to get home. For the point of this section, we're going to focus on a journey from where you're walking to either a safe house or your house. The safe house can be the house of any friend where you could go to get shelter, water, fire, food, first aid, possibly communicate, and gear up as necessary to make it the rest of the way home. In other words, we're covering journeys of less than 12 hours where food and water will be smart but not necessary for surviving the trip. To begin with, you want to make sure that you can regulate your temperature. In the summer, this may mean turning clothes inside out if the liner is a lighter color than the outside. In the winter, this may mean stuffing your shirt and pants with crumpled newspaper and or wearing a trash bag as a coat or kilt. Homeless people use this little trash bag trick, and our family used it growing up when we went to football games on cold and rainy or snowy winter nights. See, I told you I could identify with rednecks. Now, if you're in a high dust environment, you'll want to filter the air, too. Dust and smoke in your lungs will keep your lungs from being as efficient as possible. The resulting decrease in oxygen will keep you from traveling as fast and thinking as clearly as you otherwise could. Depending on what chemicals are in the smoke and dust, it could also cause permanent damage to your lungs. At a minimum, take off a piece of clothing or rip a strip of cloth that you can use to cover your mouth and nose. Try to pick a fabric that isn't too hard to breathe through. A loose-knit fabric is perfect because it will allow you to add or remove layers as necessary. If you have access to water, wet down your cloth. Water will allow it to catch more debris, and breathing the moist air will be easier on your throat and lungs. Next, you need to protect your feet. When I look at the footwear that people wear on a daily basis, I'm absolutely amazed at how flimsy most of them are. People regularly go out in half-inch thick flip-flops, fancy pointed-toe dress shoes, heels, thin strappy sandals, and the like. I'm not going to be critical about foot fashions, but if you do choose to wear this kind of footwear, you need to know how to take care of your feet if you do have to travel long distances in the city. To share the importance of good shoes for urban travel, I want to share a quick story with you. Like Neil Strauss, I've been through urban escape and evasion courses, and for a practical exam, I spent 8 hours evading 9 bounty hunters in a downtown area. I had on great hiking boots. They were actually the third pair of the same model for me. I've worn them for guiding backpacking and mountain climbing trips in Colorado, and I've worn them for rough trail running. I can wear them for a full day of backpacking with a 60-pound pack on and still have relatively fresh feet at the end of the day. After 8 hours of walking and evading on concrete in my favorite boots, my feet were shot. I didn't have any blisters. They weren't traumatized. They were just sore. We figured that with our pacing, we were averaging about 2 to 3 miles an hour with stops, and we figured we went somewhere between 15 and 20 miles. Not horribly long. And as an aside, some people have scoffed at the emphasis that I put on quality footwear, saying something to the effect of, well, I wore flip-flops for 3 days at Disney and felt fine. And I can see that happening. This is possible because Disney and many other theme parks use a special asphalt that's impregnated with rubber to keep guests from getting tired and going home early. Concrete, which is what most sidewalks are made of, is 10 times denser than asphalt and roughly 20 to 40 times denser than theme park walkways. So the reality is, unless you have a job where you wear hiking boots or running shoes on a daily basis, you're probably going to need to compensate for your footwear during a long hike in an urban area, even if there's no debris on the ground. You're going to need to make some judgment calls on short and long-term comfort and damage, but here's some general guidelines. If you're wearing heels, break them off. If you're wearing no socks, thin dress socks, or hose, put fabric or tape between your foot and your shoes to give yourself a little blister protection. If you pass a store that carries shoes, buy a pair that will allow you to move faster. If you pass a store that carries tape, buy some in case you need to repair or reinforce your footwear. And ideally, buy duct tape. As a note, electrical tape will stick to itself very well, but it won't stick to your skin real well, especially once it gets wet. If you pass a store that carries super glue, buy some for its many survival uses we've already discussed, including shoe repair. Next, walk on asphalt instead of concrete. Walk on dirt rather than asphalt, and walk on grass rather than dirt. Next, if you can walk in the street rather than on the sidewalk, walk in the center of the street. Most streets are crowned rather than flat so that the water will run off the street and road. Walking in the middle of the road will be easier on your back. If you can't walk in the middle of the street, try to alternate walking on the right and left sides of the street. If the bottom of your shoes are very thin, you can reinforce them by putting a coat sleeve, strip of cloth, tape, and any other available material between your foot and the shoe. Remember, your best solution is to start with or acquire good footwear. All of these steps are simply ways to compensate for times when you don't have good footwear with you. If you have the opportunity and it's advantageous, use the best mode of transportation you possibly can. As an example, you can buy a bike, a skateboard, rollerblades, a little razor scooter, etc. In cold weather, build up your shoes as necessary to keep your feet warm. Make sure that you don't wrap anything too tight so that you lose circulation to your feet. Next, stay hydrated and snack when possible if you have a long walk. And as you develop hot spots, apply duct tape directly to the spot. If a sore or blister is already forming, try to put some paper, cloth, or reverse duct tape over it to protect the loose skin from the tape. How do I get there from here? One of my Franken-soldier, as I affectionately like to call him, in other words, a mercenary or civilian private security contractor friends. Anyhow, he introduced me to the concept of PACE routes. And PACE stands for primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. And in an ideal world, you'll have PACE routes memorized from your place of work to your house. If you haven't completed that level of preparation yet, you should probably keep local maps in your 72-hour kits. If you're out to lunch with a group of friends and coworkers, when you have to switch into survival mode, you're probably not going to have your 72-hour kit or much of any survival gear with you. This is just life. It doesn't mean you have to carry it with you all the time. If you can, that's great. If not, deal with it. This simply means that you will need to be able to improvise and adapt and acquire a map as soon as possible. In addition to buying a map, two free sources of map that you're likely to have in almost any city are mass transit maps and maps in phone books. Almost all white pages have maps in them, as well as many yellow pages. Now, as a personal note, I alluded to my Franken soldier friend, and I want to point out that not all private security contractors and private military contractors are evil, and nor are they all good guys, like any segment of society. Now, all of my friends who are private security contractors are stand-up guys who are still serving their country even if they're not paid directly by the military. They're red-blooded Americans who would fight martial law rather than enforce it. They love America, the Constitution, and individual rights. Some of them are still in the National Guard or Reserves and pick up contractor work between drills and deployments. Not all private security contractors are like my friends. Many come from other countries, and they just don't have a natural respect for freedom. But the majority of Americans are, and enough so that I encourage you to do your research before you buy into the demonization of private security contractors by the media, Hollywood, and politicians. As a start, I've included a link to a comparison of contractor pay and soldier pay on the resource page. I think you'll be surprised by it. I sure was. So next, let's talk about urban travel after a survival breakdown, after a civil breakdown. The sheer number of potential civil breakdown scenarios makes an exact set of guidelines impractical. If the civil unrest is localized to a few streets, a neighborhood, or a section of town, the response will be different than if there's civil unrest across an entire town, which will be different than civil unrest that is regional or nationwide. In addition, your actions are going to depend on who is in charge of your immediate area. Is it the police that you know? Are they guard and military troops, who, as a note, vote conservatively 80% of the time? Are they UN troops? Are they Chinese troops? In the U.S., some recent short-term examples of localized breakdowns in civil order are small-scale riots in L.A. when the Lakers win the NBA championship and World Trade Organization riots in Seattle. These didn't affect people who were a few miles away at all, and people who weren't near the riots when they started could easily avoid them or go around them. Of course, many situations can't be avoided so easily. Two examples are the power outages on the East Coast, which is short-term, and New Orleans after Katrina, which would be considered short to medium duration. We could have varying degrees of civil breakdown as a result of similar events, terrorist attacks, high unemployment rates like we've seen in Chicago. Actually, just parts of Chicago, not Chicago as a whole. But other triggers are currency devaluations, food shortages, or other economic triggers. The guidelines that I'm going to give you are general in nature, and you'll want to adapt them depending on your particular situation. The most obvious trigger to let you know that you're in a situation where you need to follow these guidelines are when the police, fire, and EMS are overwhelmed and there's an increase in criminal and civilian violence. Along with these factors, you'll likely have one or more of the following: drinking water shortages, food shortages, breakdowns in power, water, and or communications, or currency instability. Movement away from your house. The movement that we're going to deal with in particular is movement out from your house in a time of extended civil unrest. We're going to assume that the disaster has precipitated a situation where there's a large number of people but a shortage of supplies. I'm breaking movement up into two categories. The first one is travel with no intent of trading, and the second is travel with the intent of trading. In both cases, we're going to cover travel by foot, since it's the most basic form of travel. The biggest difference between the two is the presence or absence of carrying valuables and the increased chance of identifying yourself as a good target. Well, why would you want to leave your house? The problem with survival provisions is sooner or later they run out. The goal with your survival provisions is to have enough on hand to be able to survive until you find a reliable source of consumable items like food, water, fuel, and medications. Your survival supplies will allow you to survive without interacting with anyone for a time, but eventually you'll want to start venturing out and finding ways to start replacing consumables at least as fast as you're using them. You'll probably also just want to be social, and you'll probably want to be charitable. Now, hopefully the situation that prompted you to go into survival mode is just a natural disaster or riot and will pass quickly. If not, here's some of the other reasons why you would want to venture out before order is restored. We've got water, helping friends and neighbors, identifying shelters, gangs, and other threats in your area, finding other mutual aid groups in your area, replacing supplies, finding where medical help is if you need it, gathering intelligence, finding out who's an authority in your area and creating it if there's a vacuum, teaming up with and organizing your neighborhood or city, setting, checking, or retrieving caches, finding backup shelters, finding pace routes to your backup shelters, finding pace routes out of the city. In general, finding ways to improve your situation through better shelter, fire, food, water, or security. And trading, bartering, or going to a local market. As your particular survival situation develops, you're also going to want to know what's going on around you and whether or not it's smart to stay in your current location. As we discussed earlier, if a church, community center, or park that's a block away from your house is designated as a refugee center, you may want to relocate as soon as possible or figure out barriers that your neighborhood can put between you and the refugee center. You're also going to want to know if there are any gangs or community groups operating in your area. Since Katrina, CERT and neighborhood watch groups nationwide are preparing for future unrest and will most likely have a presence as soon as an event happens. Most of these groups will be friendly, but some will be outright unfriendly to outsiders, and others will be living in a narcissistic fantasy land trying to create their own little private fiefdom straight out of Hollywood. And I really don't like that. I don't like it at all. It bothers me every time I read about it and hear people talking about it. And as you read survival websites, you'll soon see that this isn't common, but it's a very real concern. Some people are hoping for a disaster so that they'll have a chance to be important and live out their fantasies developed by watching movies and reading novels. These people are more interested in having instant social status and think that they'll be making all the right decisions like their favorite fictional character. In the event of an urban survival situation, my plan is to identify and avoid all groups and individuals with this mindset as they pop up. Next, we're going to talk about concentric circles of security. You're going to have several zones of security that increase as you go out from your house. As an example, one set of outgoing concentric circles of security could be your safe room, your house, your property, your street, your neighborhood, and your side of a physical barrier, like a river. Each one of those will be a different level. Each is a little less secure than the previous one, and you need to be more cautious and more aware as you go to less and less secure areas. At some point, the security level is going to change from one to where you're fine walking around alone to one where you'll always want to have a buddy with you. Again, this could be your house, or if your street is teamed up, your entire block could be safe enough for you to go out alone. Remember, we're not talking about the day after a flood in Iowa where everyone's helping each other. We're specifically talking about a situation where civil order has broken down. If you're in a survival situation, you also do not want to leave all of your belongings unguarded. Since you don't want to go out alone and you don't want to leave your supplies unguarded, you can quickly see why it's so beneficial to have at least a few adults on your team if your house can support it, or your neighborhood if your team is in your neighborhood. If not, you should try and team up with one or more neighbors when you go out so that you can go out as a pair and your spouses can look out for each other's homes. Next, be as boring as you can. As you're going out progressively further and further from your house, be very mindful of the people around you. Take note of their dress, level of cleanliness, how much they're carrying, and whether they're carrying visible weapons, whether they look tired or energetic, if they're walking with a purpose or listlessly, etc. This is called a baseline, and you want to match it as closely as possible. As an example, if everyone is wearing civilian clothes, you don't want to go out in BDUs wearing a helmet, rucksack, and carrying an M4 unless you want to attract attention. Another issue with dressing in a tactical look after a disaster is that you look more like an authority figure. As a perceived authority figure, you've got increased risk of bad people attacking you and good people swarming you for help. If you actually are acting in a capacity of a first responder, then this isn't necessarily a problem. But if you're moving about with a purpose, it could become a big pain real quickly. To avoid this, try to wear clothes that are as close to what you see other people wearing as possible. Avoid wearing clothing with school, city, or neighborhood names and logos. Conceal any weapons that you're carrying, unless carrying a weapon is the norm. If you carry a pack, try to make it one that looks more like a book bag or a courier bag than a tactical bag. If people are moving confidently and with a purpose, do likewise. If they're hungry, tired, and worn out, try to match it. One of my biggest tells in a rough neighborhood is that I'm white, fit, have short hair, and can have a fairly intense look unless I'm consciously trying not to. In a recent trip to an apartment complex in a seedy part of town, I was walking through the courtyard and a little 3 or 4 year old girl started pointing at me and yelling, "Cop! Cop!" while crying and clinging to her mother's legs. It was the middle of the day, and I was just dressed in a nondescript North Face shirt, shorts, and tennis shoes. She just interpreted my purposeful air, and probably the fact that I was the only white guy within a mile, as being law enforcement. If I'd been trying to be invisible and match the baseline, it could have been a big problem. The baseline will be very different as you go from your neighborhood to other neighborhoods. This can be especially true in a survival situation. If people in your neighborhood are well-fed, have water, feel safe, and are getting sleep at night, they're going to carry themselves very differently than people in an area that's suffering. As you get a feeling for the different baselines in your area, you can plan your appearance so it's easy to transition from one to another. This week, I want you to do two things. Number one, start identifying the baseline book for different areas in your city. Figure out what you would need to do to your appearance to walk through it and blend in. The baseline will likely change in a survival situation, but this exercise will train your mind to start identifying the baseline. Number two, identify the boundary lines where the baseline changes near you. It may be a city boundary, railroad tracks, a highway, a city street, or something else. What should you take with you? Well, this is going to be somewhat dependent on what will fit with the baselines in the area where you're going to be traveling. It's likely that a courier bag or a small backpack will be all you can carry externally without standing out. You can also carry extra gear and cargo pants, and depending on the season, a jacket or coat. Cinch things down and gear up so that you can jump up and down without making noise and having stuff flop all over. In short, try to avoid carrying gear that will be loud or prevent you from running. At a minimum, you're going to want to have the following items on you: water, snacks, multi-tool, lockpick, lighter, light, and communications. After that, it's going to depend on your situation. I would suggest the biggest weapon you can carry without deviating from the baseline: spare magazines, a way to purify more water, food, chain and or a cable, a padlock, a map that doesn't have any markings on it, and a tiny survival tiny survival medical kits: pepper spray, small bolt cutters, chalk or livestock marker, and a notepad and pen. And one thing to think about is zip ties. So why a chain and a padlock? Well, let me give you a hypothetical situation. You have a light industrial area near you. From previous exploration, you've identified one facility that's a couple hundred yards long, that's abandoned, and has an 8-foot barbed wire fence, but the gates at both ends are not locked. As you're checking out the neighborhood for threats and resources, you notice 3 to 4 rough-looking teenagers scoping you out. You happen to be near this facility and duck in one end and speed up to get across to the other end. As you get to the other end, the kids are halfway through and gaining on you. As you go through the second gate, you run your cable through the fence, lock it with your padlock, and take off. Now the teens have to either get over the barbed wire fence or double back in order to get you. You have the option of returning later and retrieving your lock and cable. By identifying this choke point in advance, you are able to easily defuse the situation and avoid a no-win conflict. You could also use this technique to block a door by locking the push bar or handle with a pipe, metal beam, or stud. This works better with a cable than a chain, and it works even better with big or multiple zip ties, but it depends on the door being solid enough to slow down your pursuers. The basis for this strategy comes from a fictional story by Victor Aguilar called 200. I really like Victor, and I apologize in advance for some of the language he uses, but he has some very good nuggets of information, and I'll link to it on the resource page for this chapter. As a note, actually, Victor, in talking with him, apologizes for the language in it. It's not in his character at all. And Victor's a great guy. And the reason that he wrote 200 and the reason that he's done a lot of what he's done is to equip people in Eastern European countries for another invasion by the Soviet Union. And it's his intent to help create a citizen resistance over there that can stop a Soviet invasion or stop any hostile invasion if it happens again in the future. And really encourage you to go over and take a look at his site. And it's worth reading through his stuff and buying anything he has for sale. It's all very well thought out, and it'll be worth your money. As a slight modification to this strategy, you could do the following if you had two teams out at the same time. Let's use the same scenario, except this time the gate is locked at one end. Your team and the other team are walking down parallel streets, one block apart, so that you'll pass by the open gate and the other team will pass by the closed gate. As you spot your tail, you radio the second team and have them double time it to the locked gate to either pick the lock or cut the lock. As you enter the open gate, your pursuers will think that they have you trapped and will have no reason to speed up. As long as your other team has defeated the lock by the time you get there, you can walk right through and relock it or replace it with your own. On defeating locks, practice makes perfect. Master locks are amazingly simple to rake, which is a form of picking. They're even easier once you figure out a particular lock. As a novice picking a master lock, it might take anywhere from 5 seconds to 5 minutes. Once you know the right combinations or wiggles for a particular lock, you'll be able to pick the same lock in 1 to 3 seconds in the future. As you get better, your times will improve considerably. Now keep in mind that picking locks is illegal. Actually, what's illegal is as soon as you put your pick into the lock, it's considered trespassing. And that raking damages the pins and will make the keys for the lock not work eventually. In other words, don't pick locks that you want to work in the future with a key. As an example, the lock on your house, the lock on that someone else is using in a non-survival situation. But if you have potential choke points like this that are padlocked, it might not hurt to learn the locks in your area if you are in a survival situation. Just keep your local laws in mind. This brings up the importance of knowledge about your area around your house and the importance of route selection. The more you can learn about your area now, the better prepared you will be in the event you have to switch into survival mode. One thing you should probably do this week is look for choke points in your area that could trap you in a survival situation or that you could use to stop pursuers. Mark them on your survive in place map. One that I particularly like for foot evasion is schoolyards with real tall fences. A lot of times they're unlocked most of the time or have master locks on them. And you've got a big 100 or 200 yard area that you can get a head start on someone if you lock them out and force them to go up and over or around the playground. Now, what the heck is a livestock marker? Well, I grew up on a farm, and we raised pigs the years that we thought it would be profitable. Whenever we'd work it on the pen, feed the pigs, or spend time with them, we'd have a grease marker with us. If we spotted one that was sick, injured, or needed special attention, we'd mark it with the pen so we could identify it quickly when we came back later with whatever supplies we needed. The markers look like big crayons, and they have grease in them that won't wash away without scrubbing. Carrying grease pens and or chalk with you will allow you to use predefined hobo codes or your own codes to mark points of interest for you or other people in your group when they go out. What about Murphy? Before you go out, take some time and brainstorm some possible problems that you might run into and pre-plan your response. As an example, what if you don't make it back on time? Can your team or neighborhood spare anyone to look for you? Should they look for you? You could have gotten lost, had an innocent accident, gotten arrested, or you could have gone into a bad area. If it was a bad area, do you want another pair of team members potentially meeting the same fate? These are some questions that you need to ask and answer before you go out. Here are some others. What is the appropriate response to local, federal, and international law enforcement? Your response could be different depending on which one you're dealing with. Number 2, how often will you check in by radio? What codes will you use? Will you leave your radios on, or will you just have scheduled times to communicate? What is the plan to call you back if something happens at home while you're out? What will you do if one of the pair has an injury that hurts mobility? If you're aggressively pursued, will you split up or stay together? If you split up or are split up, when and where will you meet up? How long will you wait? And how will you avoid and detect surveillance? Let's go over that quick. Oh, detecting and avoiding surveillance. I've sold silver online before to people who live locally. This involved meeting them to exchange silver for cash. Being the moderately aware person that I am, one of my first concerns was that they could easily follow me home under the faulty assumption that I had more precious metals there. As a result, I picked public meeting places like Starbucks and food courts and parked my car a couple of blocks away, sometimes even further. After the exchange, I stick around a while to read and pick a U-shaped route to get to my car so that I can easily tell if I'm being followed. Basically, if my car is southwest of my meeting location, I will go east, spend a few minutes in a retail store, go south, west, and back north to my car. The chance of anyone following the same route with the same pacing is very slim, unless they're following me. This is a very basic form of surveillance detection. Two other forms are using reflective surfaces and watching someone who stays at the same distance from you, even after stopping or changing speeds. As a note, the little box technique that I mentioned about going east, then south, then west, and then back north, in a lot of Soviet bloc countries during the Cold War, if you got caught doing that move, you were deported immediately, because almost everyone from the West had a tail, and they knew that that was a form of surveillance evasion, and if you didn't play by their rules, you had to leave the country. So it is effective. Next, switching to covert. If you suspect that you're being followed or see someone who you'd rather not recognize you, it may be advantageous to change your appearance quickly. A few simple ways to do this are, number 1, you can buy some cheap hair extensions from a drugstore or dollar store and superglue them to the inside of a baseball cap. Ideally, you want to have this available in advance. You can reverse or change your jacket, switch pants or your shirt, put in colored contacts, put on or change sunglasses, use fake facial hair, shave or dye your facial hair. Now, you may be able to quickly shave and look different. I've usually got dirty blonde or white hair, and when I shave my goatee, I end up bleeding for half an hour, and I really don't look that much different than I did originally. I get a much better effect by dyeing than by shaving. And you'll only learn this by trial and error. Have alternate clothes and appearance modifiers cached in your area of operations that you can quickly access and change into. Whatever you do to change your appearance, you need to make sure that you still end up matching the baseline and not looking like someone at a Halloween party in a cheap costume. My contacts who have done extensive undercover work all agree that the only way to get good at it is to practice. Practice will tell you what looks natural. It will tell you which disguises last for a few minutes and which will last for several hours. And practice will give you confidence in your disguise, which will help keep you from telegraphing doubt. If you get into disguises, one test you can do is to panhandle at a busy intersection near where you live. For such a safe exercise, the risk of embarrassment makes the pucker factor pretty darn high when you see someone you know. The next section is a biggie: traveling for shopping and trade. Traveling for shopping and trade is split out because at some point during your travel, people are likely to see that you have money or they will see that you bought something valuable. Both of these actions make you a good target. Before we get into that, let's back up a minute and talk about what items you should try to have on hand for trade and barter. Ideally, you want to have items on hand that you won't need for survival that you can use for trade and barter. I wouldn't trade clothes, water, or fuel unless you have an abundance of them or a way to replace them easily. Some examples of items to trade are multi-tools, cigarettes, novels, small games, soap, anti-diarrhea medication, sugar, salt, 550 cord, or, as suggested by James Rawls from Survival Blog, high-capacity magazine that you specifically own for trade. Ideally, you want consumables that are cheap right now and that people will pay a lot for if there is a shortage. Another great item is matches or lighters. Ragnar Benson tells about urban survival situations in other countries where people went through 750 matches per month. Of course, if you've quote-unquote picked the right horse and have the accepted currency on hand, you can simply use it. What I mean is that the accepted currency in a medium to long-term urban survival situation could be FRNs, or Federal Reserve notes, or dollar bills, or paper money. But it could also be junk silver, which is pre-1965 U.S. coins, or silver 1-ounce rounds, modern U.S. coins, or even gold for large purchases. The fact is, the medium of exchange can be whatever a particular society decides that it is. It can also be salt, bullets, cigarettes, gas, or something completely different. After Katrina, dollars, fuel, water, and food worked as currency. When Argentina had their massive inflation, coins were worth more than paper money. And in Zimbabwe, they knocked 12 zeros off of the paper currency and kept the coinage the same, essentially adding 12 zeros to the value of the coins. They eventually started using foreign currency to conduct business. We just don't know what the currency will be until the disaster is upon us. My suggestion is to buy some of each, with an emphasis on small denominations of cash, junk silver, multi-tools, cigarettes, and other consumables. If you love knives, water filters, solar or crank gadgets, or something else that you never seem to be able to buy enough of, then buy new versions with the intent of selling, bartering, or trading the old ones eventually. Money management, or how to keep from having all of your money stolen at once. If you've traveled much overseas, you're going to be nodding your head in agreement as you read this section. The reason is because you're going to use the same anti-theft strategies in a post-disaster survival situation that you use when you're traveling in a foreign country, in a bad part of town, or if you're like me, in everyday life. First of all, we want to get into the mind of a thief or a husband or father of a hungry family. For the most part, thefts are crimes of opportunity, and you can do a lot to prevent them by not exposing yourself as a target or making yourself look like an easy mark. I love watching animal shows. Not the stupid pet trick shows, but the wildlife shows where a lion will stalk a herd of gazelles looking for dinner. The lion knows that she isn't going to eat unless she kills, and she has to use her resources efficiently, or she and her cubs will die of starvation. As a result, she doesn't go after the largest gazelle. She goes after the one that she has the best chance of catching and killing without getting injured or using up precious resources. When you're traveling to and from your destination, you will be a ripe target, and you'll have all of the elements needed for survival, and you'll have money. Getting back into the mind of the hungry husband, father, or thief, he's going to look for signs that you're worth robbing and evaluate the potential of getting hurt, arrested, or killed. We've already covered the baseline looks. Your dress and appearance isn't going to make you stand out. And the next thing is where and how you carry your money. You always want to carry your money in front of you. In your jacket, shirt pocket, neck wallet, money belt, front pockets, cargo pockets, shoes, etc. so that you can use your eyes to help detect thieves. The most common form of pickpocketing is called the bump and pick, and takes advantage of this fact. It's very simple. One person bumps or distracts you, and a second person picks your wallet. This is easiest with a checkbook wallet, or one that my private military contractor friends calls a George Costanza wallet, which is huge and about to blow up. But it can be done with any wallet. Now think about the last time that you paid cash for something. Did you reach in your pocket, pick out the right bills by feel, and hand the cashier exactly the right bills? Probably not, unless you're blind. More than likely, you pulled out your wallet or your cash, sorted through it, and pulled out what you needed. As you did this, it's likely that you telegraphed how good of a target you are, what bills were visible to the cashier, to other shoppers. Keep in mind that a fat wallet looks valuable, even if it's full of $1 bills and discount cards. Think how many gold or platinum cards you flash when you pay for things. All of these are telltale signs that you may be a good or bad target. But what about that blind crack? Well, there's actually a point to that. Many blind people actually can reach into their pockets and pull out exactly the right currency to pay a bill without pulling out all their money. In England, they can do it because the bills are different sizes. In Canada, the bills actually have Braille on them. But in the U.S., they do something different. Since U.S. bills are all roughly the same size, they do it by using a system of folding. $1 bills are left flat, $5 bills are folded lengthwise, $10 bills are folded by width, and $20 bills are folded lengthwise and then by width. This allows them to tell what bills they're holding without being able to see it. It also allows them to reach into their pocket and pull out no more than what they absolutely have to when they're making purchases. When I'm traveling or at fairs or markets, I carry cash in different pockets. I also do this in Vegas when I'm playing blackjack. I'm a card counter, and basic money management dictates that you should always have 30 times your base bet. If I'm playing at a $25 table, I've got at least $800 on me, plus any winnings for the day and my spending money. One way I split that up is as follows. I put my spending money in my left front pocket. I put $400 in each of my cargo pockets and my winnings in my right front pocket. This way, when I want something to eat or drink, I can reach into my left front pocket and pull out all of my money, and it's only $40 or $50. When I sit down at a table, I reach into one of my cargo pockets and pull out everything that's in there and lay it on the table. I don't count out $400 from a bigger wad of cash. I already know how much I'm laying down as soon as I reach in my pocket. If I want to put down $500 instead, I pull out $400 from one pocket and a single $100 from the other cargo pocket. Since I know the only thing in that pocket is $100 bills, all I have to do is pull out the first bill I grab. With practice, you can do this so that it looks like that's all you have in that pocket. I also use a two-step process. It's handy when we're at theme parks, in the winter, when I'm skiing, or when I'm doing security and close protection and have my pockets full of other goodies. It's very simple. I start out with a single $20 bill in my pocket and more $20 bills in a neck wallet. As I get close to using up the 20, I will either pull out another 20, or if that doesn't seem smart, I'll go to the restroom, enter a stall, and pull another 20 from my neck wallet. This way I can just pull out all of my money that's in my pocket without ever showing very much money and making myself a target. You can use any of these methods, folding, putting a single denomination in a pocket, or two-stepping, to effectively hide exactly how much money you've got. The exact method is not important. Rather, focus on the concept of dividing your money and hiding how much money you're carrying. If you know that you're going to buy something expensive, know how much it's going to be and get that much money isolated before you buy it. I like to pre-position the exact amount of cash in my left front pocket so I can pull it out without having to open multiple pockets. Splitting up your money like this also allows you to empty one, two, or even three pockets in the event of a mugging and still not get wiped out. If I'm in a rough area, I go so far as to put an old hotel key and a couple of non-activated loyalty cards in my back pocket with some cash. If I need to, I can grab them and toss them at a mugger and use the distraction to either run or attack. That's all well and good for cash, but if you're trading or bartering, you'll probably need either a shoulder bag or a backpack. Use the same strategies with whatever currency or exchange medium you're using. Pack the items into various denominations so that you don't have to ask people to make change for you. This will help you get a better deal, and it will help you keep from showing off how much you actually have with you. Keep in mind that the process of negotiating, buying, and exchanging currency for another item will give people in your immediate area an idea of how much you're carrying with you. If there are very unsavory people in your immediate area, you should really think about the benefits of completing the purchase as opposed to asking the vendor to do the deal in private, waiting until the unsavory people leave, or just waiting until another time. Next, strengthen numbers. Again, the best way to avoid becoming a target is to make sure that you don't look like a target. But what if you have to make several small purchases in the open, or you need to bank one large purchase? The easiest solution to both of these situations relies on having a team with you. If you have several small purchases to make, split them up among the group. If you have one large purchase to make, you can do it in private. If you have no reason to think that anyone sees you as a ripe target, then just act nonchalantly and head home. Stay aware, but look nonchalant. If, on the other hand, you feel like you were cased or are being followed, you can approach the purchase as if it is a close protection detail, where the buyer or the most likely target is the principal and the rest of your team is the protection detail or bodyguards. Essentially, have everyone but the principal spread out and looking around for people who are paying too much attention. You still want to stick to the baseline look, but be observant of what's going on around you and who's paying attention to the purchase. There's two ways to approach this after the purchase. Number one, you've made yourself an obvious target. In this case, you'll want to travel in what's called a tight diamond formation. You'll have one person 5 to 15 feet ahead of the principal, one 5 to 15 feet behind the principal, and one person with the principal, assuming you've got four people. If you have additional people, they'll take the same relative formations, but further out. The goal here is to make yourself look like a big gazelle. When they see that there are three or four people obviously protecting the principal, they know that they'll probably sustain losses if they try anything. Number two, this is the second way. You haven't made yourself an obvious target, but you feel like being cautious. As you leave the store or market and start heading home, you'll want to use what's called a loose diamond formation. And with this one, you'll have one person 10 to 30 yards ahead of the principal, a second either with the principal or across the street from the principal, and a third person 10 to 30 yards behind the principal. Additional people can be tighter, pair up, or be further away from the principal. Done correctly, a loose diamond formation is almost indetectable in a crowd. It's just a few people going the same way on the same day. In general, the more of a threat that you perceive, the more formidable you want your group to look. The less of a threat you perceive, the more you want your group to blend in. In any of these scenarios, you'll want to go through the same surveillance detection routines, reflections, turns, and pacing, as we discussed earlier. I mentioned something at the very beginning of the chapter that's worth repeating. Everything in this chapter is easier with a bike, a vehicle, a horse, or the use of mass transit. I've illustrated everything with the worst-case scenario, which is only having the ability to walk, since the lessons would, by default, cover the easier scenarios. You've probably noticed a lot of overlap in these sections, the baseline, choke points, observing your surroundings, and that's because these are all fundamental skills. The more you practice them in the coming weeks, the better equipped you'll be to survive and thrive in both non-survival and survival situations. So here's your assignments for this week. First of all, identify three choke points near your house, work, or in between that could trap you or that you could use to evade others if necessary. Next, consciously identify the baseline look around you as you go through your week. Create their story in your mind. Do the same with people who obviously stick out. Next, see if you can identify the boundaries where the baseline look changes. And finally, try one of the money tricks mentioned to minimize the amount of cash that you expose when you make purchases. The resource page for this lesson is at urbansurvivalplan.com/516.